Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the Albion Roar Down Under, sponsored by Pure Media. My name is Richard Parker and joining me every week is the founder of the Seagulls Down Under Supporters Club, Steve Longley. So what goes up must come down, and after the fantastic performance against Arsenal, the Seagulls lost 2-0 away at Everton, which was a very limp performance. The only highlight being an impressive penalty save from Matty Ryan, and with goal difference crucial to staying up, how important would that be? Brighton have an FA Cup quarter-final to look forward to this weekend against Manchester United at Old Trafford. Will Chris Hughton put out a full-strength side? We all debate who will be in and who will be out. On today's show, our special guest is Adam Peacock. He is a Fox Sports presenter and he will be going to the World Cup. So, Steve, welcome. How are you doing?
Yeah, fine, thanks, Richard.
So let's just briefly talk about Everton. What was your assessment? I'll tell you one thing I took out of the Everton game, apart from boredom and sickness, was how much we missed Dale Stevens. Now, all those Dale Stevens haters out there, and you know who you are, do not hate on Dale Stevens, because this is the man that makes the team tick. And I reckon we played so limp against Everton because he was missing.
Yeah, and I agree with you. I mean, he just does a great job of sweeping up behind, and he seems everywhere. And you know, the other thing, I think he just gives a bit of confidence to Davy Proper as well.
That's exactly right. I watched Davy Proper over the weekend. He looked lost without Dale Stevens next to him. I mean, look, Biron Kiau is a great player, and you know, when I saw Dale Stevens wasn't playing, I was worried. But you know, Kiau can do a job, but he's not the same type of player. The two defensive midfield players we've had that have been regulars, ever present throughout the whole season, are the main reason that we've won the games we've won. And when you take one of those players out, the most influential, probably the one that links defence with attack, the one that supports the back four, I just don't think we were going to be able to perform as we did against Arsenal.
It's hard for KL to come in. You know, he's not been heavily involved. You know, he's played a couple of games. You know, with Stevens, I mean, we all know what he can do. He links up the back four and the midfield. He's always got time on the ball. He always picks the right pass. I mean, sometimes, yeah, OK, he gives it away and people criticise him for that. But no more than Knockhart gave the ball away on Saturday. I mean, that was just a joke. It was like, here you go, Everton, have the ball back. Yeah, Stevens is he's just been outstanding, honestly. He's got to be up there for player of the season. Those people that have knocked him, they're the same people that have whinged about the height of Matty Ryan, and the same people that have whinged about this, and the same people that have whinged about something else. But everybody's entitled to their own opinion. This is what we don't get. And people, you know, my opinion is that Anthony Knockhart shouldn't be on the pitch until he learns to behave himself. That's my opinion. Other people have got other opinions, and people are quite welcome to their opinions. But if you thought at the start of the season that we were going to be struggling in the bottom three, which is pretty much, you know, what most people would have anticipated before the season started, and we're not in the bottom three, you know, we're sitting quite comfortably. Okay, we are probably only, what is it now? Seven points above the top. So a couple of weeks ago, it was like four or three. Mm. But you cannot knock what the club has achieved. And I don't understand the people that continue to do it.
I totally agree, Steve. After one defeat against Everton, we've been on a run of, what, six or seven games unbeaten. We have a poor performance against Everton. And all the moaners are out going, oh, he shouldn't be playing. Oh, we didn't play very well. Oh, Hughton out. And I, oh, come on. It's one game. This season has exceeded all expectations.
Yeah, I would agree with them. We didn't play well. You know, and that's just it. It happens. We didn't play well. We didn't play well against a couple of other teams during the season. But if you thought we were going to play well every single game in the Premier League, you're living on a different planet.
Yeah.
We didn't play well. In fact, not only did we not play well, but Everton didn't play well either. You know, and we just played worse than they did.
Well, we played a lot worse, I mean, to be fair.
Yeah, but I didn't think Everton were all that, to be honest.
Do you know what the funny? I saw stats at half-time, which made me laugh, that we had more shots on target than they did. We had two shots on target and they had one. But they had all of the ball. I think they had something like 70% possession in the first half and a gazillion corners. But as Chris Hughton, if you listen to his post-match interview, he did say that, you know, they had a lot of possession and a lot of ball, but without really threatening Matty Ryan. And I would say that's a fair assessment. It was just for some reason in the second half. Again, we continued with this kind of lackluster performance. I have to say that both fullbacks were appalling on Saturday. I don't know what happened to Gaetan Bong, but he had one of his worst games
well,
for us.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm more of a Sutton lover than a Bong lover, to be honest. But I just think he brings more to the game than Bong does. Bong's quite solid, but he's prone to quite a few mistakes, and he can't deliver a ball. He cannot cross a ball.
No, he's not an attacking fullback like Suttner is. Suttner likes to get forward. His delivery is excellent.
His delivery is outstanding. And you know what? Mm. We need that. We need people that can deliver the ball from deep. Because at the moment, our wide players can't seem to deliver. And I'm not saying that about Jose, but particularly Knockhart. I mean, it's just, we're going back to the same old story. But it's gone on all season.
What was your assessment of the Anthony Knockhart sending off then? And so Leighton Baines threw the ball in his face. I don't think it was deliberate, let's be fair. And I don't know if I saw blood coming out of Anthony Knockhart's nose or not, but obviously it affected him a little bit. He was having a frustrating game anyway. And then all of a sudden he just lost it with this two-footed lunge at Leighton Baines. And, as soon as the ref ran over, I think even Knockhart knew what was going to happen. And as he sort of trudged off, he was like, yeah, I expected that. And then he got an earful from Seamus Coleman, obviously just coming back from a very bad injury. The one thing about Knockhart that I just find a bit strange is the fact that he was the victim of a terrible challenge from Britos from Watford at the beginning of the season.
Yeah.
He really should know better.
That's not the first time that Knockhart has overstepped the mark. When he feels hard done by a referee or a player, he goes and gets his own retribution. We've seen it happen before. It's not the first time. You know, he's got away with it other times, or he's got a booking. But, you know, the tackle probably hasn't been as bad. But he's gone looking for his own payback. Don't tell me he hasn't, because he does. That's what he's like. He's hot-headed. The thing is, it rubs off on people. It creates a bad feeling. There's only so many times that you can put up with things like that. And if he's like that in his day-to-day, is he like that on the training pitch as well? It's got to be wearing thin with most Albion fans by now, because it certainly is with me, I tell you.
I've got an interesting one for you, Steve. So you talk about his teammates and how they might feel, and you would then suggest that the captain of the club might have a word with him, put his arm around him. Now, here's one for you. If Danny Cullip was still the captain of Brighton Hove Albion and Anthony Knockhart was playing, how do you think he would react?
Yeah, he would have pinned him to the wall and said, grow up.
It's interesting, isn't it, what kind of reaction you know the players around and the manager has. Is it tough love, or do you need to put your arm around him and go, come on, Anthony, what's going on?
I think Chris is that type of manager that he will say, you know, come on, what's going on, blah, blah, blah. Put his arm around him and say, come on, you can do better than this, blah, blah, blah. But you saw the look Chris gave him when he got sent off.
Yeah, he wasn't impressed.
We don't know what goes on inside the club. No. We're just second-guessing things. But as fans, you read it, you know what's going on, you know the vibe. It's starting to wear thin on people. And the love that he's created, he's just start slowly but surely pressing the self-destruct button.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, he's going to miss three games. He's not going to be playing. His next game that he'll be available for, I think, is something like April the 14th. So he's almost a month out, you know, to think about what he's done. And now it's a chance for Solly March to get a run in the team. And if Solly March starts playing well, Knockhart might not see another start for the rest of the season.
You've got to play the players that are performing for you. If he takes Solly March off and he brings Knockhart on in the game and he plays well and scores the winner or lays on the winner and does something, you know, then maybe he'll get another start this season. But it's the same for any player. Personally, I would be dropping Bong at the weekend if I was the manager. Mm. But I'm not, and Chris is. So I don't get paid the big bucks. And, you know, and there'll be plenty of other Albion fans that think exactly the same.
You are listening to the Albion Roar Down Under podcast, sponsored by Pure Media, the full-service video production company based here in Auckland. Visit www.pureproductions.co.nz for more information on how Pure can create a fully customised, crafted video for your business. And of course, if you'd like to get in touch with us, our email is albionroardownunder@gmail.com. Okay, on today's show, our special guest is the Australian version of Jeff Stelling. It's Fox Sports presenter Adam Peacock. Adam, how's it going?
Good, thanks, guys. Yourself?
Yep, good, good. Good to have you on the show. Just give us an overview of what you do for Fox.
I present the football coverage, so I head up that. So I sit there on a weekend, usually Fridays, Saturdays, Mondays, doing football shows, which is good fun, bloody good fun. And in the spare time that I have when there's no football on, I do a bit of tennis as well.
Do you play football yourself?
Used to, but my back has given way. I had an operation last year, so there's no more of that. But heavily involved. I help out at the club near to us here in Sydney, Manly United, and also my son plays there. And yeah, talk about it, watch it, breathe it, basically.
Okay, so I know you're a big fan of the Premier League, and Steve tells me you support Newcastle United. So how did that come about?
Because of who my father is. He's a Geordie, so he was born there in 1939, came out to Australia as a 10-pound pom in 1969, and then I was born about 9 years later. So yeah, he's infected me with that gene, if you like, of being a Newcastle supporter.
So obviously not having the best of times this season. What's your evaluation of what's going on at Newcastle at the moment?
Oh, it's more of the same, really. I mean, we've got the right manager. We just don't have the right owner, unfortunately. And if the two ever marry up, we might be able to realise our potential. And that frustrating thing from a Newcastle perspective is that the potential is very much there. But now we're just that middle-of-the-road club who agents can use to dangle the carrot in front of a player or dangle a player in front of Newcastle, and then another big fish comes in and gazumps us for in terms of wages or ability to play in Europe. So it's a frustrating one because we get over 50,000 to every home game. We should be challenging certainly in the top half consistently of the Premier League, but it doesn't work out like that sometimes. It's just frustrating that you haven't got someone in there who's a bit more flippant with their money.
Do you think he's unnecessarily holding on to the club? Obviously, he's a businessman. He wants to get the right dollar for it.
Yes and no. He's a businessman, so it's very hard to negotiate something that, down to his heart, he probably doesn't want to sell. He'd sell it. It's a bit like the house that you like living in, that eventually you get a knock on the door one day and say someone says, I'll give you this for it, and it's way over what you think is value, so you do sell. So there was that story around January about whether or not they were going to sell the club. It didn't quite come about. It was real, but it just didn't happen. It was I think it was a head investors from the Middle East lined up, but Ashley wanted a bit more, and then they walked away. But they might come back to the table around June if we survive in the Premier League.
Which you think you will?
Just the last three games have given me great hope. I'm as hopeful now as I have been at any stage of the season. Smashed Southampton on the weekend, a really big win against Manchester United 3 games ago, and a game we should have won against Bournemouth 2-0 up away from home, and we threw it away. So, 7 points from those last possible 9 it leads me to believe that there's a few other clubs below us sorting themselves out. And for one, I do believe that you guys will survive. You've been about the best team of the three that came up in terms of adding to the Premier League and playing above or to your potential.
Steve, as a Brighton fan, and this is probably the last we'll talk about Newcastle, obviously it's a Brighton podcast, but as a Brighton fan, how do you assess Newcastle United as a club that have come up from the Championship like Brighton have?
With Newcastle, there's always that expectation from their fans, but that expectation from their fans has been going on for, well, as long as I can remember, to be honest, and they've always sort of getting the crowds in, but always coming up short. You know, even when Kevin Keegan was there, you know, and they had a great side when Kevin Keegan was there. They played some great football. You know, it was everybody's sort of second favourite team, if you like, because they were playing such attractive football. Everybody sort of took them under their wing, and everybody wanted to see somebody else win the Premier League. But you know, again, they came up short, and that's been the story of Newcastle for as long as I can remember, really.
So, Adam, let's talk about Brighton. Have you seen many Brighton games this season?
The one against Newcastle, I've seen, obviously. Every morning I wake up, I've got the Optus. Over here in Australia, we can only watch it through the internet through Optus. So I love to see how Matty Ryan's going. So yeah, I've watched as much Huddersfield and Brighton highlights this season, with Aaron Moy playing at Huddersfield, as I have Newcastle games, because that's pretty much all I get is the highlights. So of Newcastle as well, it's very hard to stay up and watch a whole Premier League game on your phone at 2 o'clock in the morning, especially with four kids, and that takes out the social life equation of going to a pub to watch it with a few mates. But yeah, I've seen a stack of the highlights of Brighton and been really, really pleased for the Brighton fans who've waited so bloody long to be involved at this level that they're actually showing that they do belong.
And obviously there's a lot of love for Brighton Hove Albion in Australia because of Matty Ryan. Are you surprised by the impact he's had this season? He had a bit of a shaky start, but obviously he's now coming good and putting in some great performances, and especially that penalty save against Wayne Rooney at the weekend. That was exceptional.
That was special. I just wish it meant something to the outcome of the game. It deserved to. But I know Matty really well. Got to know him really well since working at Fox. And I started pretty much working at Fox when he... I was at Fox for about 4 years before he came to the Central Coast Mariners. So when he started there, and I've just been blown away about how good a story it is. Like he's a kid who grew up with, I wouldn't say it was poverty, but he wasn't exactly living in a mansion, put it that way, in the west of Sydney. Raised by a single mum, him and his sister. And the mum did an unbelievable job, not just raising him, but being able to afford to get into all the trainings that he had to, and they had to borrow money off family and everything. And he only took up keeping when he was 11, when basically he was asked to come down for a trial for a rep team in the Sydney area. And he played that and then went back to play outfield the next year and then settled on being a goalkeeper after that. And the way he's gone, he met the right person at the right time in John Crawley, who's one of Australia's best goalkeeper coaches, and he had him all the way through to when he left the Central Coast Mariners. So he developed him, and his shot stopping after the World Cup in 2014, he realised he made a huge blue, and he realised that he needed to improve his shot stopping. His technical ability, as you guys would know, with his feet is almost without peer in world football. But it's just the size of the guy. Like I saw him at Wimbledon last year. Thibaut Courtois was there as well. And those two know each other from their time in Belgium. And Courtois is like a 6'6" giant. You think to yourself, how on earth, if you're a striker, do you get past this guy in goal? And Matty's like just touching over 6 foot. So his physical presence isn't quite there, but his ability shot-stopping-wise has just gone to another level this season as opposed to last. And before that, the rate of improvement the last 4 years in Matty has been sensational. And for all those reasons just mentioned in a long-winded answer, that's why I'm pumped for the guy, and hopefully he can continue to do what he's doing.
It's interesting you say that about Matt Ryan's shot-stopping, because watching him this season, that's probably the best thing about his game. He's so agile, and some of the shots that he's managed to get palms on, it's just been exceptional.
Yeah, he's a sensational athlete. I know that from standing next to him with his shirt off. And I sure as hell wasn't going to take my shirt off next to him when he was standing there. He's an amazing athlete, and he gets the most out of himself. He doesn't live this lavish lifestyle where he likes going out and things like that. He knows what he's over there for. Yep. He's got his head well and truly screwed. And I was thinking when Tim Krul came to the club, given the Chris Hughton connection from Newcastle, I thought, oh, he's in trouble here. And he did have that shaky start. But after the international break in September, he's come back, and Timmy Krul hasn't got a look in. He's been simply amazing.
Yeah, he has done really well. And there was a lot of stuff made about his height and everything else, and a lot was made about his coming out and claiming corners. But I think we've been over that on a previous podcast with the fact that it's our defending regarding corners that we're so lapsed at, rather than Matt not coming for them. I think you can't expect a keeper to come for a crowded penalty spot or penalty area to try and claim a ball that, you know, is 50-50 at best. Saying that, at one point I did see a stat that said that he was third in claiming crosses, not from corners, but just crosses in general play. Let's face it, the height of a keeper I don't think really matters too much. A lot of people put a lot of emphasis on it, but, you know, there's been plenty of... I mean, Gordon Banks, Peter Shilton weren't particularly... all keepers.
No, exactly. Adam, as you know Matty quite well, the height issue obviously comes up a lot. A lot of pundits talk about his height. You watch the games, you listen to the commentary, they always bang on about he's not the tallest keeper. How do you think that makes him feel? Does he just sort of get on with it? I mean, there's nothing he can do about it, let's be fair, but it really hasn't been an issue this season.
he would have been told that for 10 years. And, yeah, quite literally, he cannot do anything about it. So it's not like he can go and have a leg extension or something. Yeah. So, he is physically blessed with what he is blessed with. But who's to say that if he was any taller, he'd lose some of that dynamic agility that he has. So, I mean, I just get the feeling that if he continues the rate of improvement in, say, 2 to 3 years, he's going to be one of the best goalkeepers in the Premier League. He's got a little bit of a few things to iron out. I am worried about him still at corners. The game of the weekend is a classic example. Yeah. He should have come and gotten one of those.
Yeah.
As soon as he sorts that out, there's not too many glaring weaknesses in his game.
Now, I haven't seen many Socceroos games, obviously, because I live in New Zealand, but I have heard somewhere that when he plays for Australia, he literally is a sweeper-keeper, which is something he's not at Brighton. I've heard that he can come out to the halfway line and literally play that kind of Claudio Bravo role, but obviously a lot better, because he is so good with his feet. I mean, you mentioned it before. I don't think I've seen a keeper, maybe apart from De Gea, who is so confident using both feet, especially his left foot. I know he's right-footed, but his left foot, he's very reliable on.
Yeah, it's going to change for Australia because that was how the old boss, Ange Postecoglou, wanted to play. It's not going to be like that with Bert van Marwijk. I'd be very surprised, and it probably won't be. Well, it might be a little along those lines with Graham Arnold, who's going to take over after it, who's the current Sydney FC coach for those listening overseas in the local league here in Australia, the A-League. Matty's adaptable, he'll be fine, but you want to utilise something like that. He's essentially in possession, he's essentially another central defender with the ball, and that means that the two central defenders can split a little bit wider as long as you've got that protection with the defensive midfielder in the middle of the park that you don't get sliced open if anything goes wrong. But nothing's going to go wrong if Matty's got 5 seconds to pick out a pass 60 metres away. Right on the touchline, he'll put it on a guy's toe or a guy's chest. He's quite amazing, especially out of the hand as well. That lateral one, the sideways punt out of the hand. It's fantastic.
Now we had a goalkeeper last season called David Stockdale, and he gets a lot of stick for not staying with us. He went to Birmingham and decided that his level was the Championship. Allegedly. Now, I thought he was pretty good with his feet, but he was prone to the odd howler here and there. And apart from that's one thing we haven't seen from Matty with his feet is a howler. He had a couple of howlers early in the season, but he's really consistent now, and obviously that comes with confidence.
Yeah, exactly. And you've got to give a bit of credit to Chris Hughton as well, because everyone would have put, like I did, I said earlier before, put two and two together when Tim Krul came in, and you're thinking, okay, he trusts him, he knows him. I remember a huge result, and I think Hughton was the manager. I might have my years wrong, but at Tottenham, where Tim Krul made about 13 subs in a game, he basically won 3 games in the space of one afternoon. It was quite amazing, and I enjoyed just giving it to my mates, a lot of whom are Spurs fans, after that one. And you thought when Hughton got Krul to the club that, not playing favourites, but he'd give him an opportunity before you really thought it was necessary to bin Matty. But Hughton's obviously happy with Matty Ryan, and he's obviously filled him with that confidence. So it's good man management. And Hughton knows, because he said, I think, from outside looking in, given his time at Newcastle as well, that he's a really good man manager, and he's more a coach than this big personality Mourinho type manager. He's a really good man manager and gets his point across in terms of tactics really well, thinking as a player towards the players, which is important for a squad like Brighton, because they need to be as one. They don't have those huge stars that can win the game consistently out of nowhere. They need all 11 playing to the maximum of their capabilities, and that's something to be applauded, what Chris Hughton's done this season so far.
Yeah, definitely. And Steve, how important is goalkeeping coach Ben Roberts to the form of Matty Ryan?
Well, I was just going to say that, actually. You've got to give credit to our recruitment team, because by all accounts, they had Matt on their radar for about 18 months before they actually went and got him. And you saw with Stockdale, I mean, Stockdale, when he first came to us, he was prone to the few mistakes, you know. Under Ben Roberts' wing, I think he did really well. And I think the same with And I think even Matt has said that, you know, Ben is a great coach and he's only going to get better, I think, yeah.
You are listening to the Albion Roar Down Under podcast, sponsored by Pure Media. While we've got Adam still on the line, I do want to talk about the World Cup, the coming World Cup. Adam, what is your assessment of the Socceroos now in the World Cup? I know we're coming away from Brighton, but I'm interested to hear this. You know, this podcast is going out to the Australian or the Seagulls Down Under fan club. And I think they've all got an interest in how Australia do in the World Cup, especially with Matty Ryan playing. So after a change of manager, what is your assessment of how Australia will perform in the World Cup? Are they in good form? They've got a tough group, eh?
Yeah, difficult group. France, not sure that knockout's going to be there for them.
I probably doubt it.
Peru and Denmark. There's no real clarity to say that, we can be overly confident or be down in the dumps about what a shocking draw it is. I mean, the last one we got was a shocker, Holland, Chile, Spain. That was ugly. But this one is feasible that we can get it out, but we're going to have everything go our way and have our best players in Australia, for listeners who's not sure who our best players are, Matt Ryan, Trent Sainsbury, Aaron Moy, Milo Jedinak, who plays at Aston Villa, Tim Cahill, who's 87 years old and gone over to Millwall, but he just tends to score goals, ridiculous goals for Australia at the most important time. And Matt Leckie, who is over at Hertha Berlin playing in the Bundesliga. They're probably our big players that we need at their absolute best. And then we can fit other things around them come the World Cup. If all of those guys aren't firing and 100% fit, it's going to be very, very difficult. You can't carry your best players. You can carry certain players, but you can't carry your best players at a World Cup. Even Leo Messi, he was amazing at the last World Cup, but some of the others around him, like Aguero and Higuain, didn't quite fire when it was key in Argentina. It narrowly got pipped in the final by Germany still, but you look at the Germans and all of their best players at various parts of the tournament stood up. So Australia can't afford, we don't have the depth of, say, Germany or an Argentina or most of the other nations in the World Cup. We need those five or six guys that I mentioned before on fire come June.
You mentioned Aaron Moy. He's been a bit up and down this season in the Premier League. Do you think he's flattered to deceive a little bit?
I always give players a little bit of leeway. This is just one of my theories. When they're playing in a competition at that level for the first time ever. So it does take adjustment. Like, he played in the Championship last year and he got to the Confederations Cup after playing like 55 games or something ridiculous. He was gone physically. He just could not go. And they actually dropped him for a couple of matches because he couldn't pick up his legs, unfortunately. Now, this season, he's played in the Premier League and it's hard. Like, he is just about their only creative midfielder. Like, they've got to... Basically, David Wagner gets a bunch of runners around him, and he's the guy in the middle of the park that can ping passes 50 metres, 5 metres, whatever, and good at set pieces. So it has been hard for him. The best thing that happened for him is that injury against Manchester United a couple of weeks ago when he got that huge gash on his knee and he missed like 3 weeks of football. That was perfect because it meant he could just put his feet up and not have to do anything. Fitness is not a worry at this stage. It's rejuvenation. And hopefully those 3 weeks will be a godsend from an Australian point of view when we get to June, because he needed that rest. Because if he didn't have that rest, he wouldn't have had an impact, I reckon, at the World Cup.
Steve, I know you watch the Socceroos quite a lot. What's your assessment of how they'll do in the World Cup?
Oh, I mean, it's exactly as Adam says, really. It's a tall order and everybody's been playing, you know, at their best. They can't carry passengers, that's for sure. But I just wanted to say, Adam, what about the appointment of the new manager and the appointment of Graham Arnold? Should Graham Arnold have been appointed before the World Cup, do you think?
It's a hard one. Yeah, the thing is that because Sydney will end their season in May, so... If Arnold hasn't re-signed with Sydney FC, and there's all this speculation, it all goes all the way up to the start of the World Cup, and then during the World Cup, it just becomes a bit of a circus, really. So I can understand why they've done it now, and it's better for Sydney that they've got these 2 months, given that he was under contract for next season, that they let him go, and he could go out there and find a replacement. It's a little unfair, the whole situation, and Sydney having to let go a contracted coach, but he wanted to go, and there was no standing in his way, which is nice of Sydney. But it's fair enough that they've done it now, just to give everyone a bit of breathing space. And now we can, I mean, when Australia plays in 2 weeks, we've got Norway and Colombia over there in Europe. When they play in those games, all the focus will be back then on and Bert van Marwijk. So, yeah, it's a bit of a logistical issue, logistical nightmare. It's not ideal world. We're talking about Ange Postecoglou as the boss, but yeah, it's the way it goes. I remember the 2006 World Cup, Gus Hiddink was taking us all the way to the knockout stages for the first time ever at a men's World Cup, and it was a known fact halfway through that he was off after it. So yeah, you'd rather it now instead of midway through a World Cup campaign.
Can we just touch on the A-League as well while we're talking to you, Adam?
Go on.
Now, I remember when 10 years ago, or when I came over here, in fact, I was on the golf course with Dwight York back in Brighton, would you believe? And he had just won the A-League. And we talked about the A-League. And he said, oh, it's going to be really big and everything else. It's got great potential and everything else. I arrived in Australia and I thought, yeah, this has got good potential. I went down and watched all those games early on in my time here. And since then, it's taken a backward step, in my opinion. Is that fair to say?
It's stagnated, yeah. It's had its little ups and downs, but it's stagnated. It just needs a real good think and reset as to what they want it to be. And the problem for the A-League is that it's the pinnacle of Australian club football, but there's not much around it. The beauty of an English setup is the fact that you do have promotion and relegation. Remember the moment you guys had last May when it all happened for you and you get promoted and what that means for a club, a town, a bunch of supporters in all corners of the globe. And that's what we don't have. We don't have that hardened football culture here in Australia yet at a professional level that people can dream about getting promoted or have nightmares about getting relegated. And that's the big thing that we need to work on. It's not going to be easy because it's a different situation over here with the number of sports with top level sports that we've got. And also the tyranny of distance. It's expensive to get from one side of the country to the other, as opposed to just sitting on a bus for a few hours in England. So there's a whole range of issues that they need to work on, but hopefully they put their heads together. They've just expected it to happen. I get the feeling the FFA in the last 5 years, and it just hasn't happened. So they've got to reset and actually put some hard work in and make some real hard decisions to carry it forward.
So do you think there's a call for it to go back to how it was, so that there's almost like the state football, so that the teams you're playing are a little bit nearer to you and you can take away fans away without, you know, too much issue? And
I think the top level will always be a nationally based competition, but it's about getting those state level teams. It's almost like Germany in that after you drop away from the third division, you go into the regions around Germany, and that's what Australia has got in each state. So New South Wales have got a quite strong state league competition, and Victoria as well, the state that houses Melbourne. So, yeah, they've just got to strengthen those and bridge the gap between those clubs, which are pretty much as semi-professional as you can get. Like you're talking third-tier conference stuff, as opposed to the A-League, which is by far and away the most professional league going around. So there's a big gap there that needs to be closed before anything can really move forward.
And to bring in other teams, let's say they brought in a Canberra or I don't know, Darwin or something, whatever, they've got to be, you know, have the backing, and that's the tall order in itself, isn't it? Because Canberra, I think Canberra, wasn't it? They wanted to build a team in Hobart or something.
Yeah, like places like Canberra Hobart. Yeah, the next couple of teams that will come into the A-League, they won't be promoted or anything. They'll just create some clubs, I'd say, because I don't know the ins and outs of it, Melbourne, Sydney and or Brisbane. Brisbane needs one because they need a derby up there. So they might use an existing club as a basis for it and then create a club out of that. But down in Melbourne, they're talking about this big area in the southeast of the city. But the big thing is here in Australia is infrastructure, like stadiums. We share stadiums with other codes, and a lot of them are too big. If we get 15,000-20,000 seat of stadiums for an A-League, that's fantastic. But it's a hard thing to do to convince government officials of that, because they've got their head in the rugby league and AFL space. When oddly enough, and this might surprise some of your listeners, that football by far and away is the most popular sport participation-wise in Australia. There's over 1.3 million people playing the game, as opposed to 600,000 playing AFL and about 200,000 playing rugby league. So it's ridiculous numbers. They've just got to somehow tap into it. And throughout history, it's always been that way, but no one's been able, at the top level, to be able to tap into that and translate it into a successfully run, hugely popular professional league.
Is that because once it gets to state league, it's harder for those kids that have come up through the ranks to get from state league to A league?
There's a whole range of issues. If I had a kid that was good enough who looked like he was going to make a living out of the game, and he got to 16, 17, I'd actually at the moment tell him to go overseas and try his luck in an academy overseas or a reserve team overseas, as opposed to trying to break into an A-League squad. Because when you get to that age, you need games and you need quality games. And I was talking before about the NPL and the A-League gap. It's huge. So if you get caught in the NPL system, as good as it is for local communities, the level is too far removed from if you are to make that step into the A-League. So I'd send a kid overseas, for instance, at that level. So there's a whole range of issues at every single level that need to be worked on for this whole professional landscape in Australia to improve.
I'm really glad you've said that, actually, because I have said that to other people. I think, unfortunately, you have got to go abroad to be able to make it,
which is fine. It's a fantastic life experience. Some of the Socceroos that I've spoken to, I did a book back in 2000 and about the 2005 qualification process, the first time that Australia qualified for a World Cup in 32 years, and it told all the sob stories of how it went all wrong, but it also told the backstories of the guys that made it right on that particular night. And they were fantastic stories, guys who went over when they were 16, 17, foreign lands, didn't know what the hell was going on, didn't speak the lingo, they were treated as aliens, basically, by a new team. The hell, an Australian plays football, give me a break. That kind of attitude was prevalent, and these guys changed it in their own little way, but it made really successful careers out of it, and it all culminated in the ability to qualify for a World Cup for the first time in 3 decades.
Well, just talking about that, can we just touch on the youth system thing here in this country? Because I know this has happened in the UK a little bit as well, and it's definitely happened in Scotland, because in Scotland something's been done about it. But parents are taking their children to, let's say, Manly or Rockdale or Blacktown, and they're having to pay in the region of $1,500 to $2,000 to put their kids through this academy through a state league side. Is that right?
Yeah, I pay $2,400 for my kid to play under 13s.
Yeah, so now it's got to the case where it doesn't matter whether your son is good enough and is an excellent player. It's just that your parents have got to have money to put him through the academy, because you're not. What are the chances of getting spotted outside of the Manly's, the Rockdale's, the Blacktown's, the Mount Druitt's, or?
Yeah, very little. That's the system in place. But the problem is, and I can sympathise with the clubs, is that they've got a semi-professional team to fund, so a lot of sponsorship for the club goes into that. They get charged through the nose to play in competitions by the authorities, Football New South Wales, to run competitions because it runs their organisations. And basically, the football ecosystem is propped up by, mugs like me. But I don't mind it. I love watching my son and give him the opportunity of paying the cash. But I do wonder how many kids walk away from it because they can't afford it. But the club can't afford to just let them play for $500 a season, because the coaches need to be paid. The environment my son's in is fantastic, because they've got physios, they've got gear, they've got training fields, they've got everything laid out for them. They've got coaches, and everything. And the coaches are getting paid peanuts. But it's because at the top level, there's not enough money that filters back down through the ecosystem like it does in a country like England, for instance, or Germany, where the funds are so, the TV money is so big that that money does eventually trickle down to that level. And we've seen with England that they've, I think, finally worked it out, the way they do things. And you can see by the underage performances of their national teams in the last 12 months, it's unlike anything that's happened in the last 20 years. So something obviously behind the scenes has happened. And Scotland, you mentioned there, they're bringing through some fantastic young players. And some of them are actually getting their football education in places like Germany. I know of a couple of players. There's a kid at Leipzig, I think, who's really good. I might have the club wrong over there in Germany. But the point is that they've got the ability to do that. Here in Australia, where are we going to go? You have to go all the way to Europe or all the way to South America to get that type of education. That's a damn long way away from home. Not like a flight from Germany to Scotland. It's 2 hours or whatever. It's a long way away from home. So it's increasingly difficult for an Australian player to make it in this game, but they still try and they still do some of them.
For those youngsters that are playing in the lesser leagues, is there any chance, you know, I mean, I've watched some of those kids playing just local park football, and you look at some of those kids and you think, you know what, you're too good to be playing in this team, you should be stepping up a level. Obviously he can't because his parents might not have the money to put him through a Manly or a state league side or what have you, but is there any chance of that sort of player ever getting spotted in Australia? Because it seems to me not.
Yeah, they do. They do. There's enough people in Australia with contacts in Europe and the ex-players that come back and the coaches that come over here for lifestyle choices or whatever. There's ways of being spotted. It's not easy, but it's not hard. I mean, I prefer it this way than, say, sending a 13, 14-year-old over there to try and make it. That's a little too young. I mentioned before, 16, 17, that's more the age if you're going to go. But yeah, there's players over here that could easily, as you say, step up. It's just a matter of getting recognised and focused. So, it has become more of a focus, I think, in the last couple of years, the production line. Okay, if we're going to have this A-League, how are we going to make this production line work? And it's far from perfect, but at least people are recognising that this has to be a focus.
Yeah, sure. I'd just like to touch on John Moriarty's foundation, because obviously at the weekend we made a donation to that of $7,000.
Outstanding.
Raised from our game with the guys at Crystal Palace. And I'd just like to thank Mike Langridge at the Renf in the UK for sorting it out, along with Gareth Glover. And so that was great to go down and meet John and present him with a cheque. And he's doing his bit for sort of grassroots football. And obviously you know more about that than I do, Adam. I mean, I've spoken to him, but you know, you've had more dealings with him. What do you think of that whole organisation?
It's superb, because it's one of the great untapped areas of Australian football is the Indigenous community, because they are Indigenous kids that I've seen, and especially the ones that end up playing AFL, they are so naturally talented. So it's an area that we need to refocus on and build. And this foundation does it and gives opportunities. I spoke to John the other day and he said it's fantastic because these funds is going to go towards some of these talented kids being able to go and play at Carnival St. Alice Springs, right in the middle of the country, which is not easy to get to and costs a bit, to be able to test themselves against quality opposition. So, it's a wonderful thing. Commend you guys for doing what you do and handing over that donation, because it can only help.
Just for those listeners who are not sure what the charity is about, could you just explain a little bit about it?
Yeah, so they basically give opportunities to young Indigenous kids who like their football, and give them not only just a sense of playing in a good team and trying to win things and, you know, go off to carnivals, but also a mentoring role. And it's one of the big issues in Australia is Indigenous welfare, and it's a huge problem that hasn't been solved, and the way that the Indigenous communities have been treated in Australia ever since the first fleet rolled in town is nothing short of a disgrace. And it makes me cringe when I see Australians commenting on overseas cultural problems and how certain people are persecuted in certain parts of the world, and I look in our own backyard and it's happened here. and it's still happening to some degree, and it's nothing short of disgusting. And I can't quite work out how some commentators take the moral high horse and get stuck into other places when really they should be writing articles and publicising the fact that it's happened to people who we share the land with. And there's been this whole issue for a number of years about land rights and Indigenous cultures being the rightful owners of the land. But there's a lot of work that needs to be done. And this is just one small little thing. It's a little, tiny little part of society, i.e. the football community in a wider sense. And there is with the Indigenous community, the sport of AFL and rugby league, they're the big ones, but football is a part of it as well. And the Moriarty Foundation does focus in on these kids and give them opportunities and open their eyes to other choices. Because the mortality rate for Indigenous people who live outside the main centres in Australia is well below the national average. And yeah, it is a huge problem that we have. And I've gone off on tangents here, but the way that the Moriarty Foundation comes in and tries to help in its own little way can only be a good thing.
We are hoping to get John on the show actually in a few weeks' time to tell his story, because he's got a fascinating story within himself.
Lovely bloke, lovely human being.
And everything else, you know.
So, yeah. Great guy.
Yeah, it's an absolutely fantastic court. Okay, if you'd like to get in touch with us, our email is albinroardownunder@gmail.com. You are listening to the Albion Roar Down Under with Steve Longley, and our special guest is Adam Peacock. So, Adam, before you go, will you be going to Russia for the World Cup?
Funny you mentioned that. I'm sitting here. I've got a call today about we need to book in some flights. I'm actually sitting here having a look at my options. So until that's actually booked, I'm not going to Russia, but I've got an idea that I am. So,
of course he is. Yeah. Of course he is. Matt, he's got some free tickets for him.
Hopefully, yeah, because I haven't booked my tickets yet to the games. I'll be over there for the group stage. I'm not expecting too much out of that, but I've got to get off to Wimbledon because I work on Wimbledon after that. So I've got to get over to London after that and watch the knockout stages. And if Australia are in, it's going to be a hard place to leave Russia, the knockout stages. Yeah. But that's the way it goes. I'm not expecting too much, but I am expecting one thing in Russia, and that's a damn good time. Went there for the Confederations Cup briefly last year. It was good fun. And if you don't act like a dickhead, you won't get treated like one. That's the key.
But aren't you taking Bozza?
Yeah, and that could be an issue. I get what you're saying. No, he'll be right. He loved it as well. He had huge reservations about going to a place like that, but he walked away from it and said he was basically, he's got a countdown calendar in the back of his head about when he's heading back over there. So it should be a superb couple of weeks. It is a fascinating, fascinating country. And it's obviously got its issues. But as I mentioned before, when I was giving you the last answer, every country in the world, what country doesn't have its issues? So hopefully an enjoyable experience and a learning experience as well, because it's good to know about different cultures.
Yep, absolutely. Adam, it's been fantastic having you on the show. Thank you for your insight, especially into grassroots football in Australia. We're all rooting for the Socceroos. They'll be our second team behind England.
Second team. Good.
Well, because obviously, you know, we are English after all, even though we are down under. But when England go out in the group stages and Australia make it through to the knockouts, we'll be supporting them.
Beautiful. And yeah. If we go out and you make it through, I'll be there in the pub watching them as they crash out to Algeria in the round of 16. Or no, not Algeria, they're not there.
Iceland.
Tunisia or something, yeah.
All right. And also, next time you do see Mark Bosnich, ask him if he'd like to come on our show.
I will. Yeah, he's one of those bosser. He says, yeah, no worries, no problem. And then you call him 18 times and he doesn't answer. So, yeah, I'll give it a go.
You don't need to tell me, Adam.
Cheers, right. Guys.
All right, thanks, Adam. Okay, Steve, FA Cup, quarterfinal, obviously, Old Trafford, tough game, and even tougher now, I feel, that United went out of the Champions League. What kind of side do you think Chris Hughton's thinking of putting out? Now, he's already said in the Argus that he's going to put out a strong side, but, you know, with a £15 million striker on the bench, you know, that still means, you know, put him in, you put Ujoa in, that's a changed side, but it's still a strong side, so you don't know. Who's he going to put in goal? Is he going to put Matty Ryan in goal? Is he going to put Tim Krul in goal? My personal opinion is I would play Tim Krul. He's played all the other FA Cup games. He's a reliable keeper. I think you play Tim Krul.
Yeah, but who else do you play? I mean, do you go with the same lineup as the previous game, or do you want to? I don't know. It's a tough one, isn't it? I mean, look, we did that poll, didn't we, on the Seagulls Down Under page? We did that poll. Do you know? And it's not a one or the other. Do you want to stay in the Premier League or do you want to win the FA Cup? We know it's not either. We could do both.
Yes.
But if we were given the choice of winning the FA Cup or staying in the Premier League, on that poll, 95% people said they wanted to stay in the Premier League. We haven't worked all this time to get to the Premier League, to throw it away for one day of glory in the FA Cup. How's that going for Wigan?
So, look, I think you can still put out a strong side, but use the squad that we've got. Now, I'd like to see Ujoa playing. I'd like to see Lucardia playing. I would suggest we may stick with the same back four. Maybe he'll put Suttner in instead of Bong, but I have a feeling that Dunk and Duffy will play. Well, Stevens will probably come back in, depending if he's fit. And I think Esquiado will probably play as well. But then you can bring in a few more squad players. So I think it'll be a strong side, but there will be a few changes here and there. And obviously with Knockaert, he's not available, so there's going to be a change there anyway. Do you know what I feel against Manchester United? I think they've just got to go for it. I read somewhere today some of the fans saying, look, let's just take the game to them. We've got nothing to lose. Let's not play this defensive way because it's a one-off cup game. It has to be decided there. Let's just enjoy ourselves. Let's go for it. Let's play 4-4-2 and let's just go at them. And I think Sevilla in the Champions League, they got at United and United didn't like it. So I think their defence isn't that great. I reckon if we just go for it. Let's just see what happens. Cup game, you never know.
We've only got to look at the way we played up there in the league. I mean, we took the game to them. In fact, that was probably one of the first games this season that we did go out and try and attack somebody. Because it had been a bit, sort of cagey. And we sort of returned to that type of football against Everton at the weekend. But when we've gone out and attacked teams, we just look so much better. We just look, I think some of those players, the problem is some of those players, you're asking to do a defending role. And I don't think, the wide players, Knockaert and Jose, can play. Jose's not so bad. He does come back and he does help Bong out. But it's not his natural game. You're asking him to do a job that I don't think he would have been doing elsewhere in his career. You want to release those players and let them do what they're good at, and that's get the ball forward. And, when we get the ball forward and we play on the front foot, we look far better than we do trying to defend it because we look nervous at trying to defend. When we defend in a normal game, when we're attacking and everything else, it becomes second nature. It's natural. It's natural defending. When we try to defend the lead or to try and win a point, we're trying to defend from the off, almost like Everton game. It's a nervous defending. It's cagey. But when you're on the front foot, there's no better way to defend than in their half.
What you've just said does make sense. Some of the goals we've conceded have been from, hacks that we're trying to get out of the area that we've miscued and they've gone to a player like Eden Hazard's first goal, Chelsea, against us. Just nervous defending, trying to clear the ball and it just not happening.
The only time you get that nervous defending is when you're sitting deep and you go out of your way to defend.
Yeah.
You give somebody the ball. All right, it happens against teams like Liverpool, Chelsea, Arsenal the first time around. It happens because you're giving those top six sides the ball and you're saying, have the ball.
Yeah.
Now come and try and get past us.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
But with the lesser teams, you're giving them the ball, and with the Man Uniteds, the Man Cities, the Chelseas, the Liverpool, they are gonna pick you apart if they given half the chance. I keep saying it. What do I know? I'm just.
Okay. With that in mind, what do you think the score will be at the weekend?
Dare I say I'll take a scrappy 1-0? I just hope we go at it. Because I tell you, if we go at it to them, if they go a goal down, I think the fans will get on their back.
Yeah, they will. Okay, Steve, that's just about it for today. Thanks for joining me. Let's hope that the Albion can beat Man United in the FA Cup and go to Wembley for an FA Cup semi-final. You're listening to the Albion Roar Down Under, sponsored by Pure Media. If you'd like to send us an email, it's albionroardownunder@gmail.com. We'll be hopefully recording another podcast next week, so catch us then. That's it for now. Cheers.